Now I have the great pleasure of introducing our speaker. I just met him a few minutes ago, but I can tell that it's going to be a really great speech. His name is Dennis, so come on up in.
He said, make sure they can hear you through the microphone. My name is Dennis Mannix, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Dennis.
My home group is Singleness of Purpose. We meet on a Friday night in Whitestone, Queens at St. Luke's Church. 7:30, we have an open meeting similar to this. I love the open meeting. It's the showcase of Alcoholics Anonymous. It gets people up here that have at least 90 days of sobriety to tell us what it was like or what it is like today. I want to congratulate the people who came and got the chips. It takes a lot of courage to come up here in front of our peers. We don't know that you don't realize that we are your peers until after you're here a little while. But I'm going to tell you a little story, and if you've heard it before, please sit and just listen to it. But the chip came from Sister Ignatia. And Sister Ignatia was a nun that was working with Dr. Bob at St. Thomas's Hospital in Akron, Ohio. When they would bring the drunks in to get detoxed in St. Thomas's Hospital 5 days later, or how many days later that they were ready to leave the hospital, Sister Ignatia, who was about this tall, would go up to them, the man, usually a man coming out of the hospital, and she would have a Sacred Heart medallion in her hand. And she would ask that person who was getting ready to leave the hospital to please make a solemn promise to her that before they drank, they would bring this Sacred Heart medallion back to her. And they usually would. Some of them would, some of them wouldn't. But anybody who's gotten the chip today, yesterday, or any time before, you've secretly made a solemn promise to Sister Ignatia. And if you don't know who she is, read Dr. Bob in the Good Old Times and you'll get some of the history. And you've made a solemn promise to whoever gave you that chip. So Connie gave you that chip today. You've made a solemn promise to her that before you drink, you'll bring it back to her. And what that means, you'll go to any length to stay away from the drink a day at a time. My sober date is August 21st, 1979. When I told Bill, he told me that was a Tuesday. Yeah. And Bill's absolutely right, because I made my first meeting on a Monday. My father, who was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time, said to me, you have to go to AA. I was 23 years old. I looked at the phone. I said, AA, what's AA going to do for me? I had been arrested a couple of times on violent crimes. I'm a violent drunk. You put alcohol in this guy who's standing before you right now, and I become an animal. There were times that I didn't, You know, the power of the spirit, that once I became open to the power of the spirit, it moves through me and creates tears in my eyes. That I read somewhere that if you have a tear in your eye or you cry in an AA meeting, you're having a spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. So I'm having a spiritual experience thanks to you people right here. But my father said to me, you have to go to AA. So it was like a Friday, so I said, all right, I'm going to drink this weekend. I didn't tell him, of course. You know. So I got a call. I was duly addicted, Scotch and Heineken. And I got a quart of Scotch and a case of Heineken. And I sat in my apartment. I lived in Bayside, Queens. It was a four-floor walk-up. I don't think I had air conditioning. It was August. And I remember looking at the quart of Scotch, and I had the Heineken in the refrigerator, and I was saying, it's not enough. I was the only one drinking. It's not enough. Trey asked me before we were here, he said, what was your favorite drink? I said, the next one. So you know, like when you have a quart of Scotch and a case of Heineken, and you're saying to yourself, it's not enough, what happens if I run out? The opportunity of having the next one wasn't there, so I was like, all right, I got to go down to the bar and drink. But I really couldn't go down to the bar and drink, because at this time, August 20-something, 1918, 1979, I had already been indicted on a manslaughter, and I was facing 15 to 25 years in prison because I'm an animal. You know, the night that I made my meeting, August 20th, a man came up to me. It was a random act of kindness. And we're all responsible for this random act of kindness that was given to me. It's called our AA legacy. It's if you see somebody in an AA meeting you've never seen before, it's our obligation to go up and shake their hand and introduce ourselves to them, either before the meeting, like the greeter did so beautifully, or after the meeting, when the meeting's over. And Walter McMorrow came up to me after the meeting, and he had this big, beautiful smile, and he shook my hand, and he looked at me, and he says to me, "What are you high on now?" Because we come in here drinking. So I wasn't gonna drink, because I knew AA, you can't drink. So I smoked a little pot, you know? And I was like, "I smoked some pot, that's okay, right?" He says, he laughed, he had this beautiful smile. And he laughed and he says, "No," he says, "we don't drink and we don't get high one day at a time." So he says, "We'll start counting tomorrow," and that's August 21st. That's where we got August 21st, Tuesday, 1979. But leading up to that day, it was March of that same year. I went to Madison Square Garden. I had been drinking all weekend. I went to a hockey game in Madison Square Garden. I was sitting in the stands, I was drinking rum and coke, I was drinking beers, I was drinking whatever. And I passed out, I fell asleep. And I came to, the game was over, I don't know who won, I don't know what happened. We left and I got into a fight outside of Madison Square Garden. I was in my friend's car and he had a hammer. It wasn't my first time arrested on violent crime, so like for me to grab a hammer wasn't a problem. So I grabbed this hammer and I hit this kid in the head with the hammer. And he went down and we got in the cars and we left, and a few minutes later we got pulled over, I got arrested. I was in the jail cell and the cop says to me, he says, "You're in trouble." He said, "This kid's in bad shape, he's in the hospital with skull fragments in his brain. Doesn't look like he's gonna make it." So I'm like, get out of here, you're kidding me, right? So my father, who was a New York City police officer, sergeant, retired, and my mother was a New York City school teacher. I'm one of six children. I have a twin brother. I came from a loving, caring home. My grandparents were around the corner. They were immigrants from Ireland. My grandmother used to make Irish soda bread and rhubarb pies and apple pies, and she would make them in my house. She lived around the corner. And when I was a young kid in the second grade, I would come home and my grandmother would take out the Irish soda bread and put it on a table and slice it and give us a like butter, a stick of butter. And me and my brother would eat like half of that Irish soda bread. And that was the type of home that I grew up in. I grew up in a loving, caring home. There was no want, there was no need. There was want, of course, you know, but there was no need. And I remember when I was 7 years old, my mother said, "All right, you've reached the age of reason and you gotta start doing chores in the house now." And one of the chores was you gotta make your bed. So I had a little twin-size bed, and I'm making a bed, you know, like when you're a little kid, or even today, I tried to get the blanket even on both sides, and it just wasn't happening, you know? So my mother would come up and she'd say, no, you gotta pull it a little more on the other side. So I'd pull it a little more on the other side, and finally I just couldn't get it, and I went into my mother's room and I got a pair of scissors. And I cut along the line, right? And I put it in the garbage can right there in the bedroom. So I went downstairs and I said, "Mom, it's done." She came upstairs. She said, "Oh, it looks wonderful." She said, "You did such a beautiful job. All right, go out and play." So she says, I go running down the stairs and she turns and sees this cloth in the waste paper basket, and she pulls it out. She says, "It started very thin and it got very thick at the end, you know?" And she says, I laughed so hard. She says, and she loved telling that story. And the reason why I tell you that story is because my parents had desires for me to become better than them. They had desires for me to not be the person that I had turned out to. I was a 7-year-old child with this beautiful, you know,
platinum blonde hair and this face, and my mother used to tell us bedtime stories and hug me and kiss me, and so I had no reason to drink and act the way I did. And if I look back, at 11 years old, I was sexually abused by a priest. I was an altar boy, and you know, it was running rampant, of course, as you look back. And I don't blame the Catholic Church for the actions of one man. But a lot of people say to me that was what created the behavior in you, where nobody was ever going to do anything to me again. And as I got bigger, you know, as you get bigger and you get older, you become more vicious. And I became more vicious. And you add alcohol to the viciousness of us and our whole inhibitions and everything else. You know, it was first when I started drinking, I was a good dancer, I was a good talker, you know. I was taller, I was prettier, I was like, you know when you're in the bar and you get that drink and you look in the mirror and you give yourself a little wink? And you're like, I'm gonna do okay today, you know? And then you throw up all over your shoes. You know?
Oh, humbling.
It's like, what happened? I was going to stop when I got to that point, you know? And the phenomenon of craving took over after I had that first drink. And of course, you don't realize that until you read the doctor's opinion, you know, when he talks so eloquently about the phenomenon of craving and what we do to ourselves when we take that first drink. And guys, when they come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and we swear we are never going to drink again for the rest of today, and we walk out that door because we don't tell anybody what's in our thoughts, and we go pick up a drink and we say, I don't know what happened. And that's where Walter McMorrow stepped in. And it was a random act of kindness that every one of you is responsible to do to whoever you don't know who walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he shook my hand with that big smile and he made me feel comfortable. You know, this has to be a safe place for us to come. It was a safe place for me, and I was an animal. If you come through the doors, you got to know that there's hope for you. And I didn't know that there was hope for me. I thought, like, holy crap, I got 40 years of drinking left in me, you know. And Walter McMorrow says to me, he says, you didn't have 40 minutes, you know. And he says, I'm going to pick you up the next day. And he took my phone number. He didn't give me his phone number. Well, he had given me his phone number. It was funny. In March, when I had gotten first arrested before the indictment and everything else. And, well, let me backtrack to that as well. I got bailed out of jail. And my father had, again, told me I have to go to an AA meeting. This was in March of 79. And I went to a meeting. And it was the same type of thing. And the same guy came up to me after the meeting. And he had a business card. And I was like looking at it in amazement, like, you people are the scales of society. Who's got a business card here, you know? I didn't think any of you had a job, you know? Like that girl shirt that just got the coin. It says, party till you're homeless, you know? And this guy had a business card with a coffee cup, his name, and a phone number. And I was just, I'm a smart guy, you know, I'm observant. So I said, you sell coffee, huh? He says, no, I drink a lot of it. He says, but call me. And I walked up the steps of the church, and I looked at this guy's business card, and I said, no. And I threw it away. So 5 days later, I get a call at my apartment for me to go to my parents' house. I go to my parents' house, and I walk in, and my wife is there. I was married at the time. I took a hostage. I took a woman that I physically and emotionally abused because I'm an animal. And my parents were there, and I walked in, and there was a Catholic priest there, a friend of the family. He was a teacher at St. George University, and he became a friend of the family because my brother got caught stealing the tires off his car. So Father Crozier is sitting there, and he says, I need to speak to you. And we went into this little room, sort of like the TV room in the back, and he says, Stephen died today. This was the kid I had to fight with. He now had a name. He wasn't just another person in the street. He said, he died today. And I started to feel automatically, what's going to happen to me? I wasn't worried about him. What's going to happen to me? But Father Crozier says to me, he says, God loves you and God forgives you. And I didn't believe it. I said, how could God love me and forgive me? I just killed someone. And he says, he does. But I didn't say this to Father. I just said, okay, thank you. Blessed myself. We said a little prayer. He gave me absolution. And I started my grand jury hearing and, you know, the trial and everything. Well, no, the trial hadn't started yet. But anyway, I was not going to drink on my own. And then a friend of mine got shot and killed, and they threw his body in the street, because these are the type of people I was hanging out with. And I was sitting in my rocking chair up in my apartment, rocking back and forth. I had no AA in my life. I had no God in my life. God was way out of the picture when I was abused by the priest. God went out the window. I had a belief in him. I knew he was there, but my personal relationship with God was out the window. And I remember rocking in my rocking chair saying, poor me, poor Johnny, poor me, poor Johnny, poor me, pour me a drink. And I picked up a drink. So my whole idea was that I didn't need you people and I was going to not drink on my own, went right out the window. Because we have no defense against the first drink by ourselves. And like it said in How It Works, God could and would if he was sought. But anyway, my journey started on August 21st, 1979. When Walter McMorrow, just another man in an AA meeting, created what our program is. It's one man working with another, or one woman working with another. It's not the big meeting and we forget, you know. And he taught me to talk about what was happening today in my life and what I did to stay sober. And he used to ask me when I got in the car, because he would pick me up every day. He would stick out his hand, shake my hand, and say, how you doing today? Did you think about drinking? Oh, no, Walter, of course not. I wasn't thinking about drinking all day. Because you think when you come to AA, it's like, I'm not supposed to think about drinking anymore, you know? He says, listen, you're going to think about drinking. The thing is, we don't act on it. Heavy social drinkers don't think and obsess about drinking the way we do. He says, and that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a heavy social drinker. So I was like, yeah, that's what I want to be. I want to be a heavy social drinker. So he says, we can't. He says, once the cucumber becomes a pickle, it can never be a cucumber again. And he had this pickle, plastic pickle, around his neck. Wow. This guy taught me that all horses' asses aren't on horses. He says to me, go home tonight and ask God to remove the compulsion for you to drink. And I was like, ask God to remove the compulsion? Okay. Because now I was starting to trust this guy. And I was starting to believe him. And I knew that he knew peace. Because he knew God. And he was asking me to believe in the God that he believed in. So I went home. And I was on the couch. I was laying on the couch. I didn't get on my knees because I wasn't at that point yet. I hadn't broken over to that point yet. So I'm lying on my couch and I asked God, please remove this compulsion for me to drink. And I started getting this feeling down in my head. And I was like, holy crap. And then I realized my feet were higher than my head and it was just the blood rushing down. I was like, wow. But anyway, so I continued to go to meetings and I started to let my small little network know that I was indicted under a manslaughter and I was going to start my trial. My trial was about to begin. My parents went and bought me a couple of suits so I could go to my trial. And I went to my trial during the day and meetings at night. People would ask me, how's it going? And I'm like, I'm scared. They're like, it's going to be okay. Bring God with you. So I bring God with me, half believing, right? My trial was over. I was found guilty of a lesser charge. They gave me a 3-month probation investigation period, and panic struck. I was sober about 8 months at the time, and panic struck, and I went to a meeting that I usually go to on a Saturday night, and there was a guy there, retired cop, Joe Corrigan, and he says, how did it go? I said, well, Joe, I was found guilty of a lesser charge. They gave me a 3-month probation investigation period. I'm still facing 0 to 4 years in prison. I said, I don't know if I can do this 3 months. He says, well, 3 months, 90 meetings in 90 days. You did it before, you can do it again. And the weight of the world lifted off my shoulder, and the bright light came on. And I was like, right, I did it before, I can do it again, one day at a time. And that's what they always stress to me, one day at a time. You can do anything, you can stay sober for the rest of your life, one day at a time. And you do what you do, what you did yesterday, if you do it today, you pretty much got a guarantee, pretty much got a guarantee. So that's what I did. And I went through my probation investigation period, and I went to sentencing, and I was sentenced to 5 years probation. And beyond my wildest dreams, right? So you know what I thought immediately, right? Wow, I can't drink for 5 more years. And it was just a fleeting thought, but those thoughts come rushing back into us all the time, you know? We get out of a jackpot, it's like, okay, I got out of that, no problem, no sweat, I was okay, you know? But I maintained my attendance in Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept coming to meetings, you know? And I went through that 5 years probation, and I had to do the whole 5 years because of the extent of the crime. But in that time, I met a woman that maybe I shouldn't have been dating, you know? And I had been married at the time and separated from my wife because I knew what was best for me. You know, I was still doing things without clearing them with my sponsor and doing it with my sponsor. The only thing that I did right was I didn't pick up the first drink, and I kept coming to meetings on a regular basis. I had a son. My son now is 35 years old. He has never seen me take a drink or a drug, but he's seen me mad. He's seen me, you know. At 12 years old, his mother died. She died of an infection that she got in the hospital. And we were devastated. I was devastated. I wasn't with his mother at the time, but I had a love and respect for his mother because she was now a sober member of Narcotics Anonymous. And she was a wonderful mother to my son. And I met a guy a couple of years ago, and he dated her in NA. And he says, and I can tell you, he says, that she loved the father that you were to her son, which made me cry. It's making me cry now. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, made me a father beyond my wildest dreams. My father was a good father. My father didn't abuse us. But I became a good father because of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't abuse my children. I then had a daughter. My daughter just turned 29 years old. She's an MD, she's a doctor. She graduated Florida State Medical School. She's a genius. She's a chief resident. You know, she's just doing such wonderful, wonderful things with her life. My son is a beautiful young man, you know. As a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm staying down here in San Antonio with a pigeon of mine. He became a pigeon of mine. I met him at a meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous up in Flushing. And I saw him, I recognized him, I know his family, you know. So I introduced myself to him. And I got to come down here, and I'm staying in his house, and he's the father of 2 young girls. He's sober almost 13 years. He's the father of 2 young girls. And you gotta see these kids. There's not a fear in their body. There's not a, you know, like the father has never slammed the table and said whatever, you know? And I know that I had that with my father once in a while. He'd slam the table because he'd get to the point, you know? And I know that these kids and my kids have never experienced that because of the result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we claim spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. Don't ever forget to leave that, don't leave that word out, spiritual. Some people say, well, it's progress, not perfection, right? It's spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I became open to the spirit of God, God's loving grace, through you people. And when Father Crozier told me God loves me and forgives me for killing that kid, and I told you I didn't believe him, but when you people told me that God loves me and God forgives me, I believed you. Because I could see it in your face that you got the face of God. And if you ever want to see the face of God, you just come to a room of Alcoholics Anonymous and look at somebody, and you know that they know God, K-N-O-W, and that they know peace. When I was in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know God. I had no God in my life, right? What I did was, and it's funny that I'm in San Antonio, I made a Crucio, and I was sober 27 years, I made a Crucio. A Crucio is a Spanish word for short course, and it's a reintroduction to your Catholic faith. And I made this Crucio, and I met God on that Crucio, who I know now is my friend. And I know now what you people are all talking about, you know. And A is the only place you can come to and say, you people, and nobody's offended. That's not even my joke, I stole it. I was talking to Trey, he's just like, oh man, you've had some wonderful things to say to me on the phone when I'm talking to you. I just met him the other day, I was talking to him for a while. I said, none of my thoughts are my own. They all come from the people that were here before me, you know? Everything that we say here, some things are my own, you know? And then I say, no, I can't say that, it's my own. But I went to Myrtle Beach, I ride a motorcycle, I started riding in 2000. Harley Davidson, of course. And you know, I always wanted to be a tough guy when I was drinking, but I couldn't ride a motorcycle because I would have killed myself. But anyway, I bought a motorcycle and I went to Myrtle Beach for bike week. And I went to a meeting down there and I met two guys, Mike Podgy and another guy, Scott. I forget Scott's last name. They were from Columbus, Ohio. They said, you got to come out to Akron. I said, Akron? What's Akron? He said, that's where AA was founded. That's where Dr. Bob's house is. He says, it's a great motorcycle weekend. You got to come out. So 2 weeks later, me and Danny Dulligan are on the bikes leaving New York, riding out to Akron. It was in 04. It was the 69th. So we got out to Akron. We're looking around. Podgy takes us all over the place. He takes us to Dr. Bob's house. We go upstairs. And upstairs is where Dr. Bob would have his pigeons get on their knees and do a prayer of surrender at the bed. So I was like, okay. So I got on my knees at the bed in Dr. Bob's house, got halfway through my prayer of surrender, and started crying like a baby. And that's when the tears have started and they haven't stopped. Doing a prayer of surrender in Akron, Ohio, where it all began, where all they had was the Bible, themselves, and the love of one another. That's where Alcoholics Anonymous started, and that's where it grew. So to be in the gatehouse where Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson met for the first time, where Dr. Bob was going in with Annie and said, I'm going to give this guy about 15 minutes, and then we're out of here. Mm-hmm. And they were in there for hours. I forget the hours. I want to say four. I want to say six. I don't know what's right. I forget. I get all confused. I read Dr. Bob in the Good Old Times before I went out to Akron, and now I had a place in the book where everybody was. I went to the Mayflower Hotel where Bill Wilson was pacing back and forth, listening to the crowd in the bar saying, I want to go in there. He wasn't drinking on his own through the Oxford group, and he was like, I'm going to drink. And then he saw the directory, and it was so funny because there was a Reverend Tunks on the end of the directory, and Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith are from Vermont. So anyway, I'm not going to give you a whole history of this thing, but I'm going to tell you what my personal experience in Akron, Ohio was. I got to read in Dr. Bob's house. Next to Dr. Bob's house is an archive house, and that's where I read the story of Sister Ignatia. And it was at the bottom of the stairs, and I'm leaning up against the post, and I'm reading this story of Sister Ignatia, and the tears are flowing down my face, saying how beautiful it was for this little woman. She stood there with the Sacred Heart Medallion and just asked these guys to please bring it back to her, because she knew the power of God, that if they believed that God could and would, if he was sought, that they would be saved, more or less, on a daily basis. A couple of years ago, I was in a meeting on a Saturday night, and I walked in, and there was a guy in there that I never recognized. I didn't see him before. I never saw him. So I went over and introduced myself, like Walter had done for me, and now thousands have done for thousands, and millions have done for millions. And I went and introduced myself. He says, oh, I'm in from Cleveland. I'm working out here in New York. I said, oh, Cleveland. I go out to Akron every year. I got to sit next to you. I wanted to get some inside information, you know? It's like if I want to go to the Alamo, I'm going to ask you people, you know? So he says, oh yeah, he says, I said, what are you doing work here? He says, I'm driving a truck for TV and movie production. I said, that's what I do. I was driving trucks for TV and movie. And so it was so funny, right? So we get to talking, and I said to him, listen, tomorrow I'm going up to Graymore. It's in Garrison, New York. It's a rehab for men, and it's run by the Franciscan Brothers and the Sisters of Atonement. I said, would you like to come up to the Sunday morning mass with me? Now, I go to this, it's about a 40-minute ride. I go to the Sunday morning mass because they have a choir, and the choir is made up of the guys who are in the rehab. And I look at these guys, and they're up there singing the praises of our Lord Jesus Christ and God, and they're singing praises, and they're at the beginning of their sobriety. They're at the beginning of their recovery. And I'm watching these guys, and of course I'm crying, right? They bring a tear to my eye. I have a spiritual experience when I watch these men start their recovery. And it's like, it's a feeling that you've never had. And I'm open to this now, you know? I was always like, forget it. What are you kidding me? So anyway, I bring this guy up, and we get to talking, and he says, are you familiar with Sister Ignatia? I said, yeah. He said, well, Sister Ignatia is my mother's first cousin. So I was like you guys just now. I almost crashed the car, you know? And I said, wow, you're a real AA royalty. I said, this is unbelievable. This guy's father had gotten sober in the 50s, and he says, oh, I got some great pictures of my father with Sister Ignatia. And so he started bringing them, and we became, you know, good, tight AA Teamster friends. You know, it's pretty cool like that. And so I've been out to Akron every year, and I told Jimmy Lee, I said, Jimmy, I'm coming out to Akron. Okay, good, I'll meet you, you know. So he met me this year at the King School Group. King School Group is the first AA group. They met on Wednesday at 8 o'clock in the old days, and they still meet on Wednesday at 8 o'clock. So we went out to Akron this year on Wednesday to go to the King School Group, just to be there, just to be a part of whatever it is, you know? We do whatever it is. I didn't come to San Antonio in 2010, and the reason why is because I can either go to the International or I can go to Akron. And Akron's more important to me, unfortunately. San Antonio, I'm down here now. It's a beautiful city. I love it, you know? You have great AA. I'll tell you what I did Friday. I drove in, I flew in Thursday night, and Friday I had to pick up a tux for one of the guys at a wedding party. It was going to be a little late, so I was at the men's warehouse and wherever, you know. So I got my phone and I Googled AA, and they sent me to the Intergroup office. And I was like, I can't wait. I'm going, you know. The first place I wanted to go to when I was here, besides John's house and his beautiful house with his pool with his daughters and swimming around, was an AA function. I wanted to see what AA is down here, and when I go anywhere now, I want to see what AA is, you know? And I walked in, and the intergroup office is beautiful up there, and they had the little archive room, and I went in, and they had a beautiful picture of Sister Ignatia sitting right there. So it's like, you know, so now it's like, I want to tell everybody about the Sister Ignatia Sacred Heart Medallion story, you know? So last week, I was up in Maine. We went to Maine on the motorcycles, me and three other guys. Went to Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont. And as we're riding through Vermont, we're in St. Johnsbury. St. Johnsbury, Vermont is where Dr. Bob was born. And his boyhood house is there in the home. So we pulled up, and I asked the guy walking down the street, I said, do you know where Dr. Bob's house is? He says, oh, it's right up the block. He knew right away, you know? So I walk up the block, and I see the house, and I'm taking it all in, and there's a little poster that says Dr. Bob's boyhood home. And I put my foot on the front step, and the Spirit of God came through me. As soon as I put my foot on the step, and I welled up with tears, because the power is there as well. And it's because I believe. And I started to cry, because where I am today and where I was 36 years ago is a completely different place. But it's the ongoing journey that I continue here. I have pigeons that I take through the steps, the AA legacy way, the way Dr. Bob took Clarence Snyder, and Clarence Snyder is taking thousands. It's a 12-hour process. We go through the 12 steps, and we use the Bible. We read out of the Bible. We read out of the big book, the third edition. And we start with on our knees. And I don't lie on the couch anymore and say my prayers. I get on my knees. And why do I do that? I'm more comfortable that way. Some people say it's a humbling experience, especially when you first start. But now it's a reverence. I must have reverence for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I don't have reverence for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am going to, like my sponsor always said, you will revert to type. And our type is to drink. And after a while, if I'm in AA, I start getting the promises that were so beautifully written. Every once in a while, bango. About 7 years ago, I had a pigeon, and he was a prominent guy, and I never knew him, but a friend of mine knew him, and he came into AA, and he introduced me to him, and the guy asked me to be his sponsor. So he was sober 2.5 years, and he had to go to prison. And after 2.5 years, he was getting ready to go to prison. I wrote a letter to the judge and asked him to show some leniency, because I asked you people to write letters for me when I was facing prison time. And you people stepped up and you wrote letters for me. And beyond my wildest dreams and the power of God and a guy named Kenny Jackson, who since then, he was a member up in New York, kept me out of prison. I was hoping to do the same for my pigeon. He didn't get kept out of prison, but the judge gave the New York Times my letter and they printed my letter. And they said, Dennis Mannix, AA sponsor of so-and-so. And it was like, but they're not bound by our spiritual principles. But it took me about a day to get over that. You know, I had to call my children who weren't born at that time. And I wanted my children to know that it was in the paper and that it was going to be revealed and that they're friends. And you know what both of them said? That's not you, Dad. We love you, and our friends know that's not you. And AA has brought me to that point, that my children love me. I hug and kiss my son. He sits on my lap. He's 35 years old. He's a monster. And you know what gets him? I squeeze his leg right here, and he can't take that. He falls like that, and it's a little fun. But when that letter was printed in the paper, I went to a meeting and I got asked to read the promises, just out of the blue, you know? And when I got to the second promise, will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. So who was gonna get something out of it? That's what my friend said. Somebody will get something out of them knowing that you're an Alcoholics Anonymous. They'll approach you now maybe and say, listen, I have a problem with alcohol. So what's the reason for that, you know? But again, they're not bound. Nobody outside of AA is bound by our spiritual principles. We sometimes forget that these are spiritual principles that we must follow, that we must have reverence for. These rooms are rooms of miracles. I came in here a broken, scared, ready for prison. Like every one of us through this door, like, what am I doing here? We're broken, we're scared. We have to have a place of safety to come to. And that's what was given to me by the ladies and gentlemen of dignity that were here before me. And they were ladies and gentlemen of dignity. And I knew my animalistic behavior was not going to be acceptable here. Clarence Snyder said, do not let the rehabs take our meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous away. Don't let them tell us how to run our meetings. And our meetings must be run with reverence. And I truly believe it. Which means, you know, first of all, the first thing I can clear up, I'm a truck driver, I can curse with the best of you, my friend. But I will not do it in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. A closed meeting, an open meeting, because I must have reverence, because that's the first thing I can change. And they said, I have to change in order to stay sober. And I was like, I don't want to change, I like who I am, you know? And I didn't like who I was. I like what I've become in AA and still becoming. You know, like it says, spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. If I invite God in, because my God is a gentleman, if I invite my God in on a daily basis, he's going to come. And he absolutely is in love with me. And he's absolutely crazy about me. And he absolutely is not going to give me any more than I can't handle for the rest of today. You know, people say, why do we use the camel as our symbol? And Dr. Bob said, we don't use the camel because he can go 24 hours a day without a drink. We use the camel because in the morning, the camel gets on his knees and the master puts the load on him. And the camel gets up and goes through his day. And then at night, the camel gets on his knees again and the master takes the load off. And that's why we use the camel. And with that, I want to thank San Antonio for giving me the honor and the privilege. And this is the least I can do for Alcoholics Anonymous. The least. You come speak, you go anywhere speaking, it's the least you can do for Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't let anybody tell you it's service. Okay? Because again, it's the least I can do. And I want to thank Connie for such a beautiful introduction. The greatest part about coming here was getting to like give a little hug to Connie. She's so beautiful. You know, when you think of the alcoholic woman, you think of the straggly hair and the house coat and like the floppy, you know, shoes, and that's what Connie looked like when she got here. I look at her today, such a beautiful woman. I want to thank you very much.